Okay, so I'm going to hope that the change in attendance is from last week to this week is do more to the Mets and less to what I said last week. I don't know. But what do you say? Exactly. You know what? The longer people don't come to this year, the more Kansas City is going to score, and then they'll learn to value what is truly valuable. We will try to get you out before the seventh inning stretch. Okay, so we're beginning part two of the Great Torah Commentaries, and the goal this evening, like I said last week, as we spoke about last week, is to focus on Rashi. It's focused specifically on Rashi's commentary on the Torah, but to focus on one specific question, which is really a major question when it comes to Rashi's commentary on the Torah. And roughly, the question could be summed in a really kind of, I don't know, vulgar way by saying, what on earth is Rashi doing in this commentary on the Torah? In other words, we have it, children study it from a young age, they learn to study Rashi almost as intractably linked with the text of the Torah itself, but very little thought is given for the average student as to what exactly it is that Rashi is doing. Now, to begin the question, I want to just do a little bit, I want to just sort of reflect like I did last week with a bibliographical note. I brought another pile of books, a completely different pile of books this week. Again, all books dedicated to Rashi, and I just want to show you a little bit, because I think this will illustrate the point that I'm trying to bring out, which is that the major question when it comes to understanding Rashi's commentary on the Torah is to ask, what on earth is Rashi doing? So let me just illustrate this for you by showing you the books that I have before me. First of all, just one book as a little bit of a throwaway is yet another book by Abraham Grossman. We mentioned Grossman last week. I showed you two of his books. This is the third book. Again, this one is one of his volumes that is devoted entirely to Rashi. It's called Emunot V'dayot Ba'olamo Shel Rashi, which roughly means beliefs in the world of Rashi, where he tries to tease out theological, ideological, philosophical, psychological positions, because Rashi doesn't really spend time elaborating on what he thinks about things. He really just spends his time commenting on text. And so the question is, and it's a question that we're going to look into with a certain degree of depth this evening. When I say a certain degree of depth, what I mean is we're going to be here for probably under an hour, and there have been full book-length studies dedicated to this. People have spent careers or years of their career dedicated to it. So to whatever extent we could summarize somebody else's career in 25 minutes of a shiur, we're going to be doing that. But that's Grossman, the question of ideology and belief within Rashi. Again, like I said, we'll get back to that later. But just to show you a little smattering of books that are dedicated just to explaining Rashi's commentary on the Torah. I think I mentioned last week, a commentary on a commentary is called a super commentary. So I just brought you some of the older ones and some of the newer ones. What you have here is a standard classical edition of four super commentaries on Rashi that are printed together on one page. This is the Mizrahi, the Gur Aryeh, Levush HaOrah, V'Sifteh Chachamim. Just to give you an idea, the Mizrahi is roughly these are all late medieval, early modern commentaries, and the goal of every commentary in this book is to answer that same question, which is, what is Rashi thinking? What is Rashi doing? What exactly is motivating Rashi to make the comments that he's making in the context that that he's making them? And these are written by some of the outstanding personalities. The one on top here that's called Mizrahi was written by Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi. He's sometimes called Re'im, a very significant rabbinic halachic figure. the one right beneath him is Gur Aryeh. That was written by Maharal of Prague, or by Judah Lowe of Prague, one of the towering figures of Jewish thought. So he wrote a commentary on Rashi. On the right here, you have Levush HaOrah, which is written by Mordechai Jaffe. Again, an important halachic figure. On the left, Siftei Chachamim, which is printed in many editions of the Chumash, and certainly in the Mikra Gedolah, which is the Chumash with a collection of rabbinic commentaries. He's one of the standard commentaries on Rashi, Rabbi Shabtai Melamed. So this is like an early modern, maybe late medieval, collection of works that are exclusively dedicated to Rashi. Now, if we jump ahead several centuries, this one you might have seen. This is the Art Scroll Saperstein edition of Rashi. But again, what is the Art Scroll Saperstein edition of Rashi doing? Essentially, it's doing something very similar. First of all, obviously it's translating Rashi, but then it's elucidating Rashi, meaning the idea is, and we'll allude to this at least as we come along, Rashi makes many terse comments on the Torah. In other words, in his commentary on the Torah in general, he doesn't, and in any of his commentary on the Talmud as well, he doesn't spend a lot of time elaborating. He doesn't write essays or treatises. He just comments. That's what he does. And sometimes the comments are packed, and they have to be unpacked. And so that's what you have here, right there at the bottom, notes that, again, comment on the commentary, often trying to tell you what is Rashi thinking, what's motivating Rashi to make these comments, etc. The third thing that I wanted to show you is even more recent. It's called Rashi Kipshuto, which is basically, roughly, also an elucidation of Rashi, except this time it's in Hebrew. Who uses this that doesn't use the Art Scroll? So generally, Israelis, and people who think that it's not for them to read a book that's written in English. So, you have this, but it really is, it's a terrific, again, very simple elucidation of Rashi. It's become kind of a standard bar mitzvah gift that, you know, Shimshon got a nice big set of it, and, you know, all of my cousins, as they become bar mitzvah, they're getting, you know, sets of this Rashi Kipshuto, and you could see people, I saw in Israel, a lot of people were learning out of this again. Similar to what Art Scroll does. They go phrase by phrase through Rashi's commentary on the Torah, and they try to elucidate for you what exactly it is that Rashi is saying. Now, again, these elucidations are necessary because Rashi is so terse, because he doesn't waste many, many words, but also because, like I said, the central question that you have to ask when we look at Rashi's commentary on the Torah is, what exactly is Rashi doing here? In other words, assuming that Rashi, as a sophisticated intellectual individual, is not just writing a simplistic commentary on the Torah. And by the way, for a long time, Rashi's commentary on the Torah was not treated, let's say, in many circles with the gravity and the seriousness that perhaps it should have been treated. And there was one person in particular who was responsible for making that change. We'll speak about that person pretty soon. But the assumption is that if Rashi really put a lot of thought and effort and work into formulating his commentary the way that he did, then those of us who have come after him have to try to figure out what exactly is that thought and what exactly is he trying to figure out. But tonight what I really want to focus on, which is one of the big, big questions when we study and we try to understand what Rashi's commentary on the Torah is all about, is the question, again, basically, like I'm saying, of what is Rashi doing, but to formulate it a little bit more technically, the question of the relationship between the approaches to Torah that we describe as pshat and drash. Now, roughly speaking, when we say pshat, what we usually mean is the simple meaning of the text, meaning somebody who comes to teach pshat is not coming to tell you stories, and again, they're not coming to give you theological ideas, and they're not coming to go off on tangents. They're coming simply to help you understand the words of the Torah as they appear. And we'll see in later sessions the some of the commentaries that come up, especially in Spain, in medieval Spain, are very fiercely devoted to that particular approach. Understanding the words of the Torah purely without any kind of external influence on our understanding of those words. Again, we'll have the opportunity to elaborate on that, I think, in a different session. That's what we talk about when we talk about pshat. When we speak about drash, there the category is a little bit fuzzier than the category pshat, even though, as we'll see this evening, even the category pshat may be a little fuzzy. When we say drash, we roughly mean any of the rabbinic commentaries on the Torah that may not be directly related to the text, to the words of the Torah. Now, midrash could take on different forms. You have, let me start with a form you may be less familiar with, although people who come to the Gemara Shir, I've spoken about it on a number of occasions. Midrash means deriving ideas, lessons, concrete meanings from the Torah, even if those are not exactly what the word said. So the less familiar form of midrash for many people is what we call midrash halacha. Midrash halacha is the way that the rabbis read the Torah and explain the words of the Torah to derive the halachot, the laws, as they are practiced. And there are full books of Midrash Halacha, one on the book of Shemot, because Shemot is where we first have the halachic material. It's where we start talking about Pesach and Shabbos and the civil laws, right? The whole Parashat Mishpatim is dedicated to civil laws. And so you have the Mechilta on the book of Shemot. On the book of Vayikra, you have Sifra, which, of course, Vayikra deals largely with ritual laws and with Tumah and Tara, purity and impurity, with sacrifices, with the temple. But also, when you get into Parsha Kedoshim, it goes off into other areas of what exactly the definition of holy is. So in the book of Vayikra, we have Sifra. Then on Bamidbar and Devarim, we have Sifrei. Sifrei on Bamidbar, Sifrei on Devarim. And, sorry. Here again, what the Midrash does, the Midrash Halacha, goes through the Psukim of the Torah, and it tries to show you what law the rabbis derive from each individual pasuk, from each individual verse. Now, again, very often those halachot are not directly connected to the actual literal words of the Torah, right? A very famous example, thou shalt not boil a kid in its mother's milk, right? What does it mean, thou shalt not boil a kid in its mother's milk? Well, it means that you're not allowed to have a cheeseburger, and it means that you have to wait 6 hours between eating milk and meat, and it means that you have to have separate dishes, right? There was a thing that was floating around the email at some point years ago, right? That God says to Moshe, thou shalt not boil a kid in its mother's milk. And Moshe says, you mean I have to wait 6 hours? And God says, thou shalt not boil a kid in its mother's milk. And Moshe says, you mean I have to have two sinks? And God says, thou shalt not boil a kid in its mother's milk. And it says, and Moshe says, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So finally God says, Moshe, just do what you want, right? That joke is floating around. I'm sure it's been floating around before there was an internet, but nevertheless, the point is, the rabbis derive from the words Lo tivashel gadi b'chalev imo, which are repeated, or which appear 3 times in the Torah, they are repeated twice, 3 different isurim, 3 different prohibitions that form the basis of the laws of kashrut. Not to eat milk and meat, not to cook milk and meat, not to derive any kind of financial benefit from milk and meat. Where do you get that from? You get that from an assumption that the Torah wouldn't be redundant, and therefore each appearance of that pasuk has to be teaching us a separate halacha. And that's what we call midrash halacha, deriving halacha from the words of the Torah. The other kind of midrash, and that's the kind that we're going to talk about more this evening, is probably the more famous kind of midrash, and that's what we call midrash agadah. Again, agadah is a sort of catch-all phrase for all non-legal material in the Torah Shebaal Peh, in the Oral Torah, right? Whether it be in the Gemara, whether it be in the Midrashim. When we talk about Midrash Agadah, there we're talking about when somebody says, Medrash, I heard a Medrash, or the Medrash says, or whatever it is, they're talking about a Midrash Agadah. That's where you find the stories. That's where you find the theology. That's where you find the tangents. That's where you find the creative and novel interpretations. That's where you find the attempts to link different sections of the Torah or of Tanakh to each other. Again, like I said, it's hard to translate the word agadah, so we'll just use it as is. Agadah meaning anything that's not the halacha, but that is also not the simple words of the Torah, that's what we call midrash agadah. Rashi is full of, we're going to look at tonight, midrashim, midrashe halacha, and midrashe agadah. And the question is, what exactly is Rashi's goal? Why does he quote those midrashim? In other words, here I'm going to give you from Grossman. Grossman, who we keep quoting, asks 3 primary questions when it comes to trying to understand why, or the midrashim that Rashi quotes and the way in which Rashi quotes them. And they're fundamental for our understanding of that question that we're using to frame the shir this evening. Again, that question being, what exactly is Rashi doing in his commentary? So here are the 3 questions, and what I hope to do is, again, you know, I'm gonna discuss a few approaches to these questions by modern scholars, and then we're gonna take a look at some sources that hopefully will give us some insight as to what Rashi is doing. And Shelley, along the way, I think we're gonna relate to your question from last week: who was Rashi reading, right? Who are Rashi's sources? Who were the commentaries that informed Rashi's commentary? So we'll talk about that to a large extent. So here are the 3 questions that Grossman asks when it comes to the relationship to Midrash in Rashi. Number 1, how did Rashi choose the Midrashim that he was going to quote? Right? Since Rashi is full of Midrashim, but since the corpus of Midrash is far larger than Rashi, Rashi quotes selectively. So we have to try to understand what motivates him to quote the sources that he does quote. Number 2, what role do these midrashim play in the commentary? In other words, once Rashi's quoting them, what does he accomplish? What does he hope to convey to us by quoting the midrashim that he quotes? And the 3rd question that he asks for helping us understand the role of midrash in Rashi is, how were they formulated? In other words, when Rashi quotes a midrash, does he quote a verbatim, word for word, as it appears in the original source? Or does Rashi paraphrase? Does he change a word? Does he change an entire phrase? Does he reword things completely? Right? These are actually important for our understanding, because if we want to understand, like I said, what is Rashi doing, so we need to actually first observe what is Rashi doing. Right? So in other words, that question is asked on two levels. What is Rashi doing empirically? We could observe to see what is he doing with sources. Question number two is, what is Rashi doing in the broader sense? In other words, what is his goal here? The people who try to answer this question in a systematic way, again, we're going to talk about some 20th century scholars, and the first person is really, I said before, that the person who kind of put Rashi on the map as a serious commentary on the Torah in a way that maybe had kind of fallen away, unfortunately, over the years. We're talking about Nechama Leibovitz. Nechama Leibovitz was probably the most influential modern teacher of Tanakh. She died in Israel in the 1990s. She had many, many students. She taught Torah and Nevi'im and Ketuvim, and she taught commentaries, and she taught people how to read Torah through the commentaries, and what are the commentaries doing. Like I said, extremely, extremely influential teacher. The way that Tanakh is taught, if you go to any day school now, if you go to Israel where Tanakh is taught in advanced institutions, she really laid the foundation for it. And she was recognized for this as a great, great teacher in her own lifetime. By the way, she always wanted to just be known as Mora, as a teacher. Nothing less and nothing more. But my father always tells us, my father was always, you know, she made a major impression on my father. He studied in Israel for the year. He was in BMT, Beit Midrash LaTorah, which was one of the early American programs in Israel. And she taught a course there in Chumash. And what she did, both in BMT and really everywhere in the world, was she created these worksheets that she would give out. They're called Gilyonot. Gilyonot just means sheets. But Nechama's Gilyonot have become like a basis. You can go online, you can find all kinds of websites dedicated to them, where they just give her questions about the text, with some clues where to look into certain commentaries, and some guiding questions, what you should be thinking about while you read these commentaries. And like I said, I know very, very wise scholarly rabbis who work with these. I know teachers who give them to their students to work with. They really speak to people on every level. So my father told me that when he used to, after Nechama used to teach when in his school, I won't tell you who, but afterwards she used to have private sessions with two rabbis, one of whom is a very, very well-known professor, the other of whom is a Rosh Kollel, and they used to go in and they used to have a private session studying Tanakh with her. In other words, we're talking about like people on every level benefited from her teaching. And like I said, she's very famous for making people deal seriously with Rashi's commentary on the Torah. And she has a whole essay that she wrote that was published in one of the volumes of her lectures on the Torah. And the volume in Hebrew is printed in the volume on Sefer Shemot. In English, it's actually not printed in the volume on Shemot. It's printed in a completely separate volume. And she has an entire essay dedicated to the relationship between Rashi and the Midrash. What are Rashi's factors? What guides Rashi when he chooses a Midrash and when he quotes a Midrash? And Nechama Leibovitz promoted the idea, and she pushed very strongly for the idea, that Rashi has one goal, one primary goal, and that is what we call exegesis of the biblical text, which is a fancier way of saying Rashi wants you to be able to understand what it says in the Torah. Rashi's goal is to solve problems in the text, and any midrashim that Rashi cites are cited in order to help you solve problems in the text. In other words, she believes very firmly, again, if we make that distinction between pshat and drash, pshat meaning simple meaning, and drash meaning sort of, you know, fanciful tangents and other kind of issues, that Rashi's main goal is to teach pshat, is to teach you to read the Torah on a simple level, and any midrash that he quotes is ultimately there to serve the purpose of pshat. Where did she come up with this idea? Because like we said, Rashi is full of all kinds of interesting side points, interesting tangents, lists of rabbinic commentaries. She got this from It's actually the first source on your sheets. That's what we're going to look at. What is the closest thing to a methodological statement that we could find in Rashi's commentary on the Torah? So here's the problem. Many other Torah commentaries, Ramban, Ibn Ezra, wrote a preface. They wrote a statement. They wrote an introduction to their commentary in which they tell you what they're trying to do. Right? Makes sense. I'm about to do something. I'm about to give you an entire commentary on the Torah. So let me introduce to you what it is that I'm trying to do, what my method is, what my questions are, what my values are. Like I said, Ibn Ezra does that, Ramban does that, many of the commentaries on the Torah write that. Rashi didn't do that. We just have Rashi's comments on the text. But within Rashi's commentary on Parsha Bereshit, the story of Adam and Eve in Gan Eden, in the Garden of Eden, Rashi has an interesting statement commenting on a verse that may be difficult to understand. That's the first source on your page, is that Pasuk, and Rashi's comment on the Pasuk. The pasuk is as follows: Vayishmeu et kol Hashem Elokim mitalech bagan l'ruach hayom, vayitchabei ha'adam v'ishto mipnei Hashem Elokim b'toch etz hagan. They heard the voice of the Lord God going in the garden in the direction of the sun, and the man and his wife hid before the Lord God in the midst of the trees of the garden. Very difficult pasuk on a theological level, on a philosophical level, to understand. What does it mean? The voice of God is walking through the garden. What does it mean for the man and the wife, for Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, to hide from God? All kinds of difficult questions arise. And of course, when a difficult question arises in the Torah, and you're reading the Torah, and you're a traditional Jewish person who has their Chumash Rashi open in front of them, your eyes immediately go to Rashi. And you're like, Rashi, help me out here. Solve the problem for me. Tell me what on earth the voice of God is doing walking through the garden. Tell me what on earth Adam and Eve are doing hiding from God. I have no idea what's happening in this pasuk. Rashi tells you, I am actually not going to tell you what any of those things mean. Here's what Rashi says. This is the second source on the page. Vayishmu. Vayishmu is the introduction, right? Whenever we read Rashi, Rashi always has an introductory word or phrase, which is his citation from the pasuk that he's commenting on, right? So it's Vayishmu, they heard. In other words, they heard the voice of God. Rashi says as follows. Yesh midrashei agada rabim. There are many agadic midrashim. Ukvar sidrum rabotenu al mechonam bebereshit rabba. And the sages have arranged them in their proper order in bereshit rabba, ubashar midrashot, and in other bodies of midrash. In other words, there are lots of midrashim. If you want to learn midrash, if you want to get a theological interpretation, there are lots of midrashim you could look at, but Rashi says, and here's where I underlined, va'ani lo bati el lipshuto shel mikra, ula agada hamiyashevet divrei hamikra, davar davur al ofanav. Rashi says, but I have come only to teach the simple meaning of scripture, and such agada that clarifies the words of the verses, each word in its proper way. That is a translation of Rashi. Now this translation of Rashi very much reflects Nechama Leibovich's understanding of what it is that Rashi was trying to do. Namely, Rashi says, I will not explain to you what the voice of God is doing in the garden, because that's not what I'm trying to do here. What I'm trying to do is to help you understand what the words of the Torah mean, and if I do quote a midrash, the midrash is only there to help you understand what exactly the words or the phrases of the Torah mean, and my goal is very much not to tell you midrashim and theological concepts. That's what Nechama Leibovich reads this statement of Rashi, and she reads it as his mission statement. She reads it as Rashi defining what it is that he's trying to do in his commentary on the Torah, so that when you ask, what makes Rashi choose a midrash, Nechama will tell you that Rashi tells you what makes him choose a midrash. The midrashim that he chooses help you understand, help you explain problems in the text. We're going to see in a few moments how Nechama Leibovich even takes midrashim that seem to be fanciful, and or you know, that seem not to be addressing the words of the text directly, and even in those midrashim, she shows you how Rashi is dealing with problems in the text or with issues, questions that arise in the text, rather than trying to give you some side point. So, according to Nechama Leibovich, the bottom line, for Rashi, the most important thing is pshat, the simple meaning of the Torah, and the only reason to learn midrash, the only reason to study other sources, is to get insight into the simple meaning of the Torah. In other words, there are questions that arise, and what these midrashim will do is they will help you think about those textual, basic questions that come up. Now, A source that's often cited that says that Rashi's ultimate goal is to really just help you understand the words of Torah, and not too much more than that. That Rashi's goal is to give you pshat, and not to give you anything more than pshat, is a statement that Rashi's grandson made in his commentary on the Torah. Rashi's grandson is Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir. Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir is better known as Rashbam, because Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir. Rashbam. Rabbi Shmuel, Rash ben Meir, Bam. When you take the standard edition, the Mikraot Gedolot Chumash, which is the Chumash that has many rabbinic commentaries printed on the page, Rashbam is one of the standard commentaries that is printed on the page. And Rashbam, unlike his grandfather, does not quote Midrashim. He only cares about the simple meaning of the text, to the extent that he's willing to go places that would seem to be revolutionary and problematic, that seem to challenge the standard rabbinic understanding of the Torah. For example, we always say that according to Halacha, I was just talking about this the other week at Shalashudas, because some people have put out a censored version of Rashbam. Very famous statement of Rashbam. He says, how is a day structured according to Judaism? What comes first, day or night? So according to Halacha, the night comes first, right? We light Shabbos candles and the next day is Shabbos. We have the Seder and the next day is Pesach, etc. Rashbam says, yes, that's what the rabbis say, that's their understanding, and of course when it comes to Halacha, we would never, God forbid, deviate from the rabbis. And the source that's usually cited in favor of that is the phrase Vayihi Erev Vayihi Boker, right? First there was evening, then there was morning, right? Rashbam says, that's not really what that phrase means. What it really means is Vayihi Erev, it was night, and the day ended. Then Vayihi Boker, then the next day began. So he says, really the night is the end of the day, and the morning is the beginning of the next day. This is not a standard rabbinic commentary, so when Rashbam writes it, he even has a whole, you know, little aside there, almost an apology. I would never tell you to deviate from the halacha, and of course when it comes to halacha, what the rabbis say is the primary meaning. However, that's not really the pshat in the Torah. Again, Rashbam, when he says that the halacha is a primary meaning, he's not just engaging in apologetics. Rashbam was one of the authors of the Tosfot. He was a halachist of the first order. And so he means it when he says that the halachic meaning is meant to be taken seriously, but he also believed in pshat. So Rashbam, in his commentary on the Torah, this is on Parshat Vayeshev, and I don't remember the full context, but this is a very famous and very frequently cited statement of Rashbam, because here he talks about what it was like to study with his grandfather. He had the privilege of learning with Rashi, who was his grandfather. And so this is the third source on your page. It says, Rashi's grandson comments on Rashi's method. Rashi's grandson, Rashbam, says, V'gam Rabbeinu Shlomo Avi Imi Meir Enei Gola Shepiresh Toran V'yimuktuvim Natan Lev L'faresh Pshuto Shel Mikra. If you look, the English says, our master Shlomo, my mother's father, who enlightened the eyes of the exiled, who elucidated the Torah, the prophets, and the writings, paid attention or was careful to elucidating the simple meaning of Scripture. V'afani, Shmuel ber Meir Chotno. I, his grandson, Shmuel, the son of Meir, his son-in-law. Nitvakachti imo v'lefanav. What it means, I argued before him. V'hodali, and he admitted to me, Sheilu haya pnai haya tzarich la'asot perushim acherim lefi apshatot hamechadshim b'chol yom. Rashi, writes his grandson, admitted to me that if he had time, he must make a new elucidation based upon, or he should have made a new elucidation based upon the simple meanings that are discovered each day. That's what Rashbam says by Rashi. And again, people like Nechama Leibovich, who take Rashi as a pashtan, as a person whose ultimate goal is for you to understand the Torah on a simple level, look at that statement of Rashbam to tell you that was indeed a value of Rashi. Now it's true that maybe it's a value that evolved, because Rashi himself says, you know what, if I was writing my commentary today, I would have been more pshat and less midrash. Fine. But, and we also see that last phrase, l'fi ha'pshatot ha'mechadshim b'chol yom, according to the simple meanings that are discovered each day, that as Rashi studied with his students, including his grandson, they discovered new meanings in the Torah. They tried to understand the simple meaning of the Torah. And Rashi's students and his grandson, who was a student, and others, are going to write commentaries in the Torah that actually are more inclined towards simple meaning and less inclined towards rabbinic midrash. This, in a nutshell, is the position of Nechama Leibovich. Rashi is what we call in Hebrew a pashtan, somebody who's interested in the simple meaning of the Torah, and when he does quote rabbinic sources, it's basically to give you that simple meaning. Other scholars are less convinced. Other scholars tell you that the words pshat and midrash in Rashi, pshat doesn't mean like the simple meaning of the text. It doesn't mean that Rashi wants you to get what the words mean absent or divorced of the rabbinic interpretation. In fact, another scholar who is very, very frequently quoted here is an Israeli scholar named Sarah Kamen, and she says that Rashi does not really want you to only understand the literal meaning, the simple meaning of the text. In fact, she says, the goal of Rashi's commentary is not to get you to think about the simple meaning of the text, but it's actually to create a commentary on the Torah that is based upon rabbinic sources. In other words, she says that what Rashi is trying to do is to take rabbinic sources that you closely to the words of the Torah. In other words, when Rashi, again, she accepts this as that first Rashi that we read as a methodological statement, right? Pshutosha mekraul agada hamiyashevet divrei hamikra davar davur alofanav. That line about agada that clarifies the words of the verses, each word in its proper way. But she says, that doesn't mean that my goal, says Rashi, is to give you a simple meaning of the Torah. It's to give you a rabbinic commentary on the Torah, a digest of rabbinic commentaries in the Torah. But the midrashim, the rabbinic commentaries that Rashi chooses, are the ones that are more closely connected to the words of the Torah themselves, and less those that kind of, again, go off on tangents, and less those that go off, you know, and explore side points. In other words, unlike the Nechama Leibovich, which says Rashi's main point is to get you to understand the Torah itself, what Sarah Kamen says is that Rashi's goal is to get you to understand how the rabbis interpreted the Torah with a commentary that used very closely to the words of the Torah. Yeah, Gary.
So, thinking about Rashi's place in history,
yes.
Why was this his direction at that time in history?
Okay, so for the benefit of those listening, I've been asked to repeat all questions for those who hear it on the recording, because it doesn't always pick up audience questions. So the question is, why is, in this particular moment, why is this Rashi's direction? So I think this relates to a certain extent to what we were talking about last week. In other words, Rashi is sort of standing on a threshold between two worlds, between two methodologies of interpretation. Assuming that Rashi really does you closely to the simple meaning of the words, whether it means Allah Nechama Leibovich, that his goal is really to give you the simple meaning, or whether Allah Sarah Kamen, that his goal is to give you a rabbinic commentary, but one that is roughly connected to the simple meaning of, or to the words, let's say, of the Torah. Either way, we know that his students kind of took this idea of being close to the words and the simple meaning of the words, and they, in turn, again, like Rashbam, like others, Rav Yosef Kara and others, who really put more effort into going after the simple meaning. So it could be, again, like we were saying last week, that this is, I think, Grossman's approach here, that Rashi is kind of standing on the threshold of this renaissance, of this rebirth, of this intellectual rebirth. And the renaissances in general, I don't know if that's the actual plural, but tend to include trying to engage and trying to really understand older texts. So, okay, what was happening that Rashi was responding to? So that's a good question. So one of the problems, like we said, so part of it is a zeitgeist, right? In other words, a zeitgeist that cares a lot about, that has an intellectual rebirth, that cares a lot about learning texts and studying text. Part of it derives from his education in the academy of Rabbi Gershom that we spoke about last week, which again is what they did there. They read and commented upon text, and what we see both in his commentary on the Torah and in his commentary on the Talmud, that Rashi takes what he's learned in the yeshivot in Germany and he just takes it to the next level and he perfects it and he professionalizes it. There's partially that. Again, one of the big questions when it comes to Rashi, possibly because he is the sort of borderline figure in a lot of ways, he's a borderline between, again, sort of a purely midrashic approach to Torah and a more pshat-oriented approach to Torah when it comes to the commentary on the Torah. He's a borderline between when it comes to studying the Gemara, between just sort of like, you know, explaining the words very, very simply, which is primarily what he does in the Gemara, and his grandchildren who are going to go off and create the Tosfot, which is a completely different approach to Torah learning, dialectics and contradictions and resolution of contradictions in a way that nobody had done beforehand. So the difficult thing then is to understand whether Rashi is a revolutionary, or whether Rashi is an outgrowth of what came before, and of course, as we could probably gather, he's both. In other words, but the big question is, and this is a question that scholars deal with, both in terms of, again, Rashi on a historical level, and in terms of the content of Rashi, some of which we'll look at this evening, to what extent can we, should we, do we read Rashi in the context of what's going on around him, as responding to the world around him, as a product of the world around him, and to what extent is he the natural outgrowth of the type of Torah scholarship that was just evolving in France and Germany during that time, and to what extent are those phenomena related? And that's, historians don't agree about that. Like I said, I've been presenting Grossman's approach, which is to see it as part of a general zeitgeist in which, right, Jews and Christians and everybody are experiencing this intellectual renaissance, and Rashi is part of that, but like, not everybody agrees with him. Again, there are some people who say, what are you talking about, Grossman? Assuming that there was a 12th century renaissance, it's not going to be until, you know, the century after Rashi dies, and so he's not really part of it. You really have to look at him in the context of what came before. So it's a good question. It's a hard question to answer, but it's one of the, I would say, important questions that comes up in the scholarship about Rashi, which is, you know, what exactly he's doing. So we're going to, again, try to look at it a little bit tonight to see what we can do. Yeah, Betsy. Okay, interesting question. Were people, I'm going to repeat that question because it's a packed question and it's something we're going to talk about this evening. It might not be what you think you're asking, but were people finding meanings in the Torah that Rashi thought were incorrect and therefore he created his commentary to try to give you the correct commentary? Part of the answer to that question is yes, but it might not be the people that you think it is. In other words, let's take Ibn Ezra as the counterpoint to Rashi. Ibn Ezra, by the way, sets himself up to the counterpoint of Rashi. Incidentally, I didn't put it on the sheets, but whatever Rashbam says about Rashi and Pshat, forget what Nachum Leibovitz will say 1,000 years later about Rashi, or whatever, almost 1,000 years later about Rashi and Pshat, Ibn Ezra, who was living in Spain about a generation later, is the first Spanish authority to ever talk about Rashi, and he says, this dude is not talking about Pshat, if I could put it in a vulgar way. I will tell you about Pshat, forget Rashi, Rashi is just giving you Midrashim, there is no Pshat in that commentary whatsoever. So, Ibn Ezra, he will actually engage with people who he thought were misinterpreting the Torah. He's going to engage with the Karaites, who, I guess we'll do a couple of sessions on Ibn Ezra, because fascinating, the history is fascinating, and the approach is fascinating. Karaites have not made their way into Ashkenaz, certainly not by Rashi's time. The Karaites are the people, are though the sect of Jews who rejected rabbinic authority, who were very powerful and very creative during the Middle Ages, mostly in the Muslim countries. And the Ibn Ezra engages with Karaites not infrequently in his commentary, because the Karaites wrote commentaries on the Torah. And Ibn Ezra will tell you they're wrong for this reason, they're wrong for that reason. Maybe we'll look at Ibn Ezra, we'll talk a little bit about the fight with the Karaites. The people that Rashi may have been engaging with in his commentary on Chumash, and was absolutely engaging with in his commentary on Nevi'im and Ketuvim, are the other group of people who we thought were misinterpreting the Torah, namely, not Karaites, but another group of people who learned the Torah, Christians. Right? Rashi, we're going to look tonight to see, maybe we can get some insight from Rashi and into his approach to the Christians and Christianity, but next week we're going to see some very, very clear examples, including some cool manuscript discoveries that show us how Rashi is very much engaging with the Christians, and we'll talk a little bit about the Jewish-Christian polemic during that time. Anyhow, so we've seen two approaches so far, both of which tell you about Rashi's commentary on the Torah. A third approach, which is a very important approach to deal with, is an approach that says that Rashi does what he did. Rashi chooses what he chose, and his commentary is not about pshat, and it's not about just telling you midrashim, but Rashi has a clear ideological, theological, educational objective in his commentary on the Torah. There are a few modern scholars who have gone in that direction. And, you know, that approach seems to make sense. Why does it make sense? Because we have to ask ourselves, like we said at the beginning, if Grossman says one of the fundamental questions is, which Midrashim did Rashi quote? So, obviously, if Rashi is quoting certain Midrashim and not quoting other Midrashim, he must have had some criteria, right? So, there's likely that if he's choosing a Midrash that has a lesson or a theological point to it, that he's choosing that one for a reason, and he wants you to know what that theological point is, right? So, there are a number of scholars who have said, our goal is to identify that Rashi's commentary is full, is rife with an agenda, a theological, an educational agenda, and that's what Rashi is all about. Again, Grossman's approach, since we keep coming back to him, seems to make the most sense. First of all, he identifies five problems with trying to figure out what Rashi's ideological agenda was. Problem number one is distinguishing between ideology and commentary. In other words, when you read Rashi, how do we know when he's just trying to explain to you what's happening in a pasuk? And how do you know when he's making an ideologically loaded statement? We'll see some of that tonight. Number two is Rashi is very terse, like we keep saying. He doesn't write essays. He doesn't go off on long tangents. So it's hard to say this is his theology, this is what he believes. Number three is that Rashi is generally quoting sources, right? He's not making up his own commentaries. Number four is you don't hear Rashi's own voice in his commentary. He never says, and I believe, or almost never says, right, this is what I think, which you will find other commentaries saying. Other commentaries will say, you know, Rashi says this, and Ibn Ezra says that, and I think that, you know, that they're wrong for reasons X and Y and Z. That's the fourth thing, is that he doesn't put his own voice into the Peirush, to his commentary. And the fifth point, that is something which is very, very important in modern scholarship of Rashi, but which we're not going to talk about, is textual issues. Meaning, Rashi has been copied and published, and different versions of Rashi have existed throughout the ages, and the printed versions of Rashi that we have are not necessarily the most authentic versions of Rashi. They're not necessarily the commentary that he wrote or that his students wrote. You could find, you know, one book that I looked at that we'll be quoting soon, a woman wrote a book on Rashi and the Akedah that we're going to be talking about a little bit. She said she looked at 31 different manuscripts of Rashi in order to just write her book on the story of Rashi's approach to the Akedah. 31 different manuscripts. Now, I'm sure they weren't all drastically different from each other, but the point is you'll have a turn of phrase here, you'll have a little change of a quote there, and because Rashi is so terse, the differences between the manuscripts, how they were copied or how they were passed on through the ages, will make a difference in how we understand Rashi. Okay. All of this is by way of introduction. Now what we're going to do is take these ideas, right? Nechama Leibovich saying it's all about understanding the text. Sarah Kamen saying it's all about giving you a rabbinic commentary on the text. Other people saying it's all about, teaching you theology and what we call hashkafa and approach to life. And Grossman basically saying it's somewhere in between all of those, that there's definitely some ideological considerations, and there's definitely some textual considerations and some pshat considerations. Let's take a look at some of Rashi's commentaries. The first thing I wanted to do tonight is to take one comment of Rashi and to tear it apart and to see what Rashi is doing. Now, Shelley, this is where we're going to start getting to your question of sources, because what you see in this Rashi, what I gave you here is, I broke Rashi into three statements, and then I gave you a list of Rashi's sources of what he's doing. So what we want to do is, we want to see what Rashi is doing with those sources, we also want to see what he's not doing with those sources, and see if we can figure out a little bit of what Rashi does. So the pasuk, the verse that we're going to be talking about is, again, from Akedah Yitzchak, everything we're doing is from Akedah Yitzchak, because this week, I wrote in that email, if you missed it, this week we're reading Parshas Vayera, we'll be reading the Akedah this week, so I figured let's take timely things. So, this Pasuk, again, the Pasuk is the second Pasuk, the beginning of the commandment, or the request, or however you want to say it, of the Akedah. Vayomer, right, we're after it says, analyzing Rashi on Genesis 22:2, that's where we're going. Vayomer kach na et bincha yichidcha asher ahavta et Yitzchak v'lech lecha el eretz ha-moria v'ha'aleyu sham le'ola al achad ha-harim asher amari lecha. And he said, God said to Abraham, please take your son, your only one whom you love, Yitzchak, go to the land of Moriah, bring him up there for a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. Now, there are a lot of things in this pasuk that Rashi deals with and that require elucidation. I am mostly interested in Eretz HaMoriah, because I like the way that Rashi was structured, and I like the way he teaches us a little bit about his sources and a little bit about what it is that he's trying to do. So I did not give you the quotation clause, but it's Eretz HaMoriah. Well, Rashi, what I want to do is let's read a little bit of Rashi, and we'll do this Nechama Leibovich style. What Nechama Leibovich always told his students to do is read Rashi and try to figure out what it is in the Pasuk, what it is in the verse that's troubling him. What is it in the Pasuk that he's responding to? So Rashi says, Eretz HaMoriah, again, the Hebrew and English, I broke it down to three phrases, Yerushalayim. V'chein b'divrei hayamim, livnot et beit Hashem b'Yerushalayim b'har Moriah. The land of Moriah is Jerusalem, and so it appears in 2 Chronicles 3:1, to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah. So before we go any further, what's Rashi doing here? He's explaining what is Har HaMoriah, exactly. In other words, Rashi's giving you, in this case, what is ostensibly, in his mind, certainly the simple meaning of the text. Meaning, we've all been programmed to read Eretz HaMoriah and Har HaMoriah, to read the Akedah, and to immediately say, oh, where did Abraham go? He went to the Temple Mount. Of course, there had been no temple, and Yerushalayim was not necessarily of any particular, you know, significance at that point. So when you read Eretz HaMoriah, our programming is to say, Avraham went to Jerusalem, but when you actually go back to the words of the text, it just says he went to the land of Moriah. And it does not tell us what the land of Moriah is. So Shelley tells us that Rashi starts straight away by telling us simply, what does that mean? Eretz HaMoriah is Yerushalayim. Now, how does he know that Eretz HaMoriah is a reference to Jerusalem? Because he has another pasuk, a verse elsewhere in Tanakh, that bears it out, that explains it to him. To build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, livnot et beit Hashem b'Yerushalayim b'har HaMoriah. So here you see a basic tool of Rashi, right? The assumption that the Tanakh can explain itself, more or less, right? I want to explain to you the simple meaning, that Mount Moriah is Yerushalayim, and I want to tell you, how do I know that? Because it says it elsewhere in Tanakh, very simple. Tanakh is self-explanatory, and if you don't have the words here, you'll find them elsewhere, you'll find that somewhere else. Okay, that's clause number one in Rashi, and that's where he's just sort of giving you the simple meaning. Now he quotes a midrash. V'rabotenu pirshu, al shem shemisham hora'ah yotza'ah liYisrael. And our sages explain that it is called Moriah, or Moriah, because from there, religious instruction, Hora'ah, goes forth to Israel. What on earth does that mean? What is Rashi doing there? Again, Rashi is really quoting an earlier source. But what is that earlier source doing? That earlier source slash Rashi. What they're doing is they're playing with the root of the word, Moriah, right? And they're trying to find some connection to some other word that has a similar sound. Again, I don't know that grammar was an exact science in the Midrash. In fact, I'm fairly certain that grammar was not an exact science in the Midrash. But one of the things that the Midrash does is that it phonetically connects words to similarly sounding words in order to give you an explanation of what that word is. So here you have the word Moriah that is phonetically connected to Hora'ah. Hora'ah means religious teaching. Specifically, what that means is Hora'ah is not just religious teaching, but it really means halachic instruction. So why is that place that we now know as Jerusalem, why is that the place where religious instruction or halachic ruling went out to the Jewish people? Because who met in the temple, in the Beis HaMikdash? The Sanhedrin met there. Right? So this is a reference to the Sanhedrin who would create religious instructions and they would send that out to the Jewish people. So here we have Rashi quoting a Midrash. It's called Moriah because the word Moriah is related to Hora'ah. That's where Hora'ah, religious instruction and halachic rulings, went out to the Jewish people. That's clause number two. Clause number three in Rashi. V'onkelos tirgamo al shem avodat haketoret sheyesh bo mor nered ushar b'samim. And onkelos rendered it, you'll see the land of service, we'll get to that in a minute, as alluding to the service of the incense, which contained myrrh, myrrh meaning more, which is, again, phonetically related to Moriah, more Moriah, spikenard and other spices. Okay, so what is Rashi doing here? Rashi is, A, giving us a basic explanation of the word Moriah, telling us where it is, right? Basic pshat. Then he quotes a rabbinic midrash, that Moriah is a place where a teaching goes out to Bnei Israel. Then he engages with Onkelos, which is the ancient Aramaic translation of the Torah, and he explains to us how Onkelos translates the word. He didn't quote Onkelos for us, which he often does. In this case, he didn't actually quote Onkelos, but he tries to explain to us why Onkelos translated the word the way that he did. OK, Okay? Now, first of all, so let's talk about Shelley's question, which is, who are Rashi's, not who are his Rebbeim, but what was Rashi reading? So we know, and we see this in, throughout the literature, that Rashi is engaging with a very wide range of rabbinic midrashim. He's reading Midrash Rabbah, he's reading Midrash Tanchuma, he's reading the Talmud Bavli, and he's looking at Unkelos for the literal translation of words. Unkelos is Aramaic commentary, which is considered authoritative. And so he's looking a little bit at Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer. Now, this is all important. Why is it important? You know, let's skip his source from Two Chronicles. That's just an explanation for us about what the Moriah is. It just tells us that Shlomo built the Beis HaMikdash on Mount Moriah. I'm more interested in the second two parts of Rashi, where he talks about the Midrash and where he talks about Unkelos. Okay, now the Midrash is interesting. I gave you two sources here where Rashi deals with the Midrash. The first one is a Midrash Bereishit Rabbah. The second one, it says Babylonian Talmud 16a. Believe it or not, the Babylonian Talmud does not have only one 16a. It has about 20-some-odd of them. This is from Masechet Tanit. I just left that out on the sheet. Let's see how the rabbis, where Rashi gets this from in the Midrash. So it says, Lech Lecha al Eretz HaMoriah, right? This is on the, again, we're on the second page. We are now on the third source on the second page. Lech Lecha al Eretz HaMoriah, Rabbi Chiya Rabba, Rabbi Yanai. There's a debate between Rabbi Chiya Rabba and Rabbi Yanai as to what exactly the word Moriah means. Charamar lamakom shehoraya yotza laolam. One said it means the place from which religious instruction goes out to the world. V'charna amar, the other one, while the other explained it, lamakom sheyira yotza laolam. The place from which religious awe, yira, goes out to the world. Interestingly then, the Midrash that Rashi is quoting here doesn't have only one interpretation of Moriah, but, you know, based on phonetic relationships, but it has two, right? It has one that Rashi quoted, religious instruction, Hora'ah, but then it has another opinion which says that the word Moriah is phonetically related to the word Yir'ah, fear, awe. Rashi omits that. He doesn't bother with it, right? By the way, he might not it's not clear if he got it from the Medrash Rabbah, or if we got it from the Talmud Bavli, the next source here, has a very similar debate. My Har HaMoriah. What is the meaning of the name Mount Har HaMoriah? Pligiba Rabbi Levi Bar Chama Rabbi Chanina. Rabbi Levi Bar Chama and Rabbi Chanina disagree with regard to this matter. Chad Amar once said that the name alludes to the great Sanhedrin, right? Har Sheyatzam in Hora Ali Yisrael. It alludes to the great Sanhedrin that convened there, this is Steinsaltz, as it is the mountain from which instruction, again, Hora'ah, religious teaching went out to the Jewish people. V'chad amar, and one said, Har sheyatzam imenu mora li'umot ha'olam, that it is a mountain from which fear, mora, awe, went out to the nations of the world. Steinsaltz fills in as this is the place that signifies God's choice of the Jewish people. So here we see a great example of Rashi quoting a midrash, and it would seem to be a midrash that is not necessarily fully related to the Pshuto Shel Mikra, the simple meaning of the text, but also you have to wonder what does Rashi, on what basis did he choose that particular text, and on what basis did he omit the other half of the text? In other words, he chooses one opinion in the Midrash, he omits the other opinion in the Midrash. In this particular case, it's a little bit harder to understand what would make him choose one and not choose the other one. So that's one of the questions that you always have to ask when you want to really understand what Rashi is doing. You see that he quotes Midrashim, and this particular Midrash, again, is not necessarily about the simple meaning of the text, but on the other hand, you see that he chooses from a collection or from a number of options of Midrashim, and he chooses one of them. That's one thing that I wanted to show you. The next thing that I wanted to show you is the last source on that second page, which is Rashi engages with the Targum, the Aramaic translation of Unkelos. So we said, Unkelos tirgamo al shem avodat haketoret sheish ba mor nered ushar besamim. Unkelos, like we said, renders it as alluding to the service of the incense, which contained myrrh, spikenard, and other spices. What is that? The last source, you see Unkelos, is, you know what, I'll just read the underlined two words, la'ara pulchena. La'ara pulchena literally means to the land of worship, or whoever did this translation of Top said, to the land of service. So again, what is Rashi doing? Rashi's quoting Unkelos, which is his go-to for translations of the Torah. And what he sees is that when Unkelos translates here, now Unkelos, again, not to get into uncles at great length, uncles generally gives you a literal word-for-word translation of the Torah without going off on tangents. But here, rather than uncles translates the word Moriah as pulchina, meaning worship. I don't know if the word Moriah literally means worship, or if uncles was thinking about something else. And Rashi tells you that actually, no, the word Moriah does not mean worship, but uncles sees the connection between Moriah, the name of the place that Abraham was instructed to go, on one hand, and the word mor, which is one of the spices that was used in the Ketoret, in the incense, on the other hand, and that's how Unkelus makes that connection. So what Rashi is doing for us here is taking one of his sources, Unkelus, unpacking it for us to tell us why Unkelus chose the words that he chose. So here we are trying to figure out why Rashi chose the words that he chose, and at the same time, Rashi is trying to tell us why his sources, Unkelus, chose the words that they chose, or chose the words that he chose, and all of that is, again, in that one Rashi on Eretz HaMoriah. So what you see out of this Rashi, again, the only reason I chose this Rashi is to show you three things that Rashi does. Thing number one is explain the simple meaning of the text, right? Eretz HaMoriah equals Yerushalayim in his mind. Number two is quote a Midrash for us, but that his quote of the Midrash is not so simple that we have to try to understand what goes into his quotation of the Midrash, because what he quoted also points to what he omitted. That's number two. Number three is Unkelus, right? Again, he usually looks for the meaning of the basic words from Unkelus, and here he has to try to explain to you why Unkelus chose the words that he chose and why he translated in the way that he translated. All of that in that little commentary of Rashi. I want to show you a couple of other things. Well, let me see how much time we have left. You know what? Let's skip the stuff about Abraham's donkey. The thing about Abraham's donkey is side point is to talk about how Nechama Leibovitch would explain things that seem to be off topic, but we'll put that aside for a second. What I want to talk about for a moment is, what we're doing just until now is just to take apart a Rashi and to see what it is that Rashi is doing and the different components of his Rashi, what his method is. What I want to do now for a moment is to see if we could figure out from Rashi any, again, ideological arguments, and particularly when it comes to the Akedah. So I mentioned before, a woman named Devorah Schoenfeld wrote an entire book called Isaac on Jewish and Christian Altars, in which she compares Rashi's commentary on the Akedah to a contemporary Christian commentary on the Akedah, and she tries to show us that Rashi actually, again, has a theological, ideological agenda in choosing the commentaries that he chooses. Now, I gave you three Rashis here. She deals with more than that. But the idea basically is this. What is the message of Akedat Yitzchak? That's the question, right? The question you have to understand, especially when you're dealing with the commentary like Rashi, who's just going verse by verse and explaining to you what's happening and trying to explain the Pesukim to you, can we piece together a message? Can we look for a theme in Rashi's commentary and to say, yes, Rashi is trying to make an ideological point? So this woman, Devorah Schoenfeld, she argues that when you look at Rashi's commentary on the Akedah, he is indeed trying to make an ideological point. And the point is about, I actually gave it to you on the sheet, the punchline is right there, the chosenness of the Jewish people. Now, I should point out that Grossman, in his book here, Emunot V'Deopa Olamot Shel Rashi, dedicates a lot of space to Rashi's belief about the uniqueness and the specialness of the Jewish people, and Rashi's particular, or how Rashi finds it throughout the Torah and in his commentaries in the Torah and in Tanakh. The specialness of the Jewish people kind of goes hand in hand, of course, with the refutation of those who claim that the Jews are not special, or that somehow our place in the world has been supplanted by some other groups. In other words, Rashi may not explicitly, in his commentary on the Akedah, answer charges by other religious groups that the Jews have somehow been supplanted in history, that somehow we've lost our unique place in history. Nevertheless, Rashi definitely alludes to it. So let me show you her argument here, which I understand. But, you know, I understand it while still adding Grossman's proviso that sometimes it's hard to know whether Rashi is really being ideological or whether Rashi is just really commenting on the text as he sees fit. So we're going to look at comments from the first two psukim of the Akedah, and then we're going to go towards the end of the Akedah, and we're going to share with you what Schoenfeld says about this. So from the very beginning, right? Achar Advarim Ha'ela. Now, Achar Advarim Ha'ela, after these things, right? That's how the Torah introduces the Akedah. And of course, the obvious question is, whenever the Torah says after these things, you have to try to understand what are the things to which the Torah is alluding. And the Midrash talks about it, and the Gemara talks about it. And again, here we have Rashi choosing one source over another, right? Even though Rashi very frequently quotes the Midrash Rabbah, here he opts for Sanhedrin. Now, let's read what Rashi says. The Hebrew is second, the English is first, but we're going to read the Hebrew first, then the English. So the Hebrew says, Achar Dvarim Ha'ela, Yesh Me'rabotenu Omrim Achar Dvarav Shel Satan. After these things, some of our sages say, this is in the English tells you in Sanhedrin 89b, that this happened after the words of Satan, the accusing force, or accusing angel, if you will, Shaya mekatreg veomer, mikol se'uda she'asa Avraham, lo ikriv lefanecha par echad o ayel echad. Sorry. Satan comes before God and he says, the Torah just told us that Abraham made a mishne gadol, he made a great feast when Yitzchak was weaned, and Satan says, of every feast that Abraham made, he did not sacrifice before you, God, one bull or one ram. So Satan comes in before God and he accuses Abraham of having neglected God, essentially. Back in the middle of the second line of Rashi in Hebrew. Amar lo, God says to the Satan, klum asa ele b'shvil b'no? Back in the English, God said to him being Satan, does he do anything but for his son? Ilu hayiti omer lo zavechoto zvachoto lufanai lo haya ma'akev. Yet if I were to say to him, sacrifice him before me, he would not withhold him. In other words, the background of the Akedah, according to Rashi here, quoting the Gemara, is Avraham is accused in the heavens by the Satan of having abandoned God, and God says, really, Avraham made all those parties just for his son, I'll show you that Avraham is not abandoning me, I'll tell him to sacrifice that son, and Avraham will jump at the request. That's one comment. Okay, next comment in Rashi. V'yesh omrim achar dvarav shel Yishmael, she'yamid pa'er al Yitzchak, she'mal ben 13 shana v'lo micha. Some say that this is not about a competition between God and the Satan, but it's about a competition between Yitzchak and Yishmael. Some say, after the words of Yishmael, who was boasting to Isaac that he was circumcised at the age of 13, and he, Yishmael, didn't protest, right? So what did Yitzchak respond? Amar lo Yitzchak, be'eber echad atam mireini, ilu amar li HaKadosh Baruch Hu, zvach atzmecha lefanai lo hayiti ma'akev. Yitzchak said to him, with one organ you intimidate me? If the Holy One, blessed be He, said to me, sacrifice yourself before me, I would not hold back. Okay? Now, what Rashi does here, and you can see this here, is that he puts together an amalgamation of a Gemara in Sanhedrin and a Midrash Rabbah. What's very interesting about this, and I'm just going to sort of talk it out, is that the Midrash Rabbah also has Abraham being accused in heaven of having abandoned God, but not by the Satan, but actually by, well, for lack of a better phrase, we call the good angels. It's the good angels who accuse Abraham of having abandoned God, and God tells them, I'm going to prove to you that Abraham is actually loyal and that he will sacrifice his son if I ask him to do so. So what does Rashi do? Rashi chooses the Gemara that particularly sets up the Satan as the adversary, and then he puts together the Midrash that puts Yishmael as the adversary. What Devorah Schoenfeld argues is that throughout the story of the Akedah, what we're going to find is the Jewish people who are represented by Abraham are challenged on a theological level. We're challenged sort of, you know, on a hypothetical level. That's what's represented by the Satan, a force, a theological force that's opposed to the Jews. And on the other hand, we're opposed on a human level by human beings who are opposed to the Jews. And the Akedah answers both the theological opposition and the human opposition. In other words, both the argument against Judaism from Christianity and the Christian people who claim that we have supplanted you as God's chosen people. So that's what she explains why Rashi chooses those sources. And again, she sees on a number of occasions that there's always an adversary. There's always somebody who is challenging Abraham's place in, for lack of a better phrase, we'll say God's mind or in God's universe, whatever it is. And the goal of the Akedah is to show to the world that Abraham actually deserves it, right? So that's the second source we have here. Kachna, ein na el lashon bakasha. Amar lo, b'vakasha mimcha, amod li b'zeh nisayon, shelo yomru harishano lo haya bahem mamash. Please take the Hebrew kachna, this is again our second source, is only an expression of a request. God said to Abraham, I request of you, I beg of you, pass this test for me so that people will not say that the first ones, the first tests, had no substance. Again, this notion of there's somebody, an adversary, challenging Abraham's past, saying that what you once were is not meaningful and it's been supplanted by something else. So the Akedah shows, no, Abraham passing the Akedah, Abraham, and by extension, Abraham's descendants, the Jews, deserve the place that they occupy in, again, for lack of a better phrase, God's mind. And finally, towards the end of the Akedah, after Abraham is up there on Mount Moriah and he's willing to sacrifice his son, and he stopped from doing so, God says, "Ki ataya dati kire lukimata." Now I know that you are fearful of God, right? That you fear God. What does Rashi say? "May atay yeshli mala hashiv la satan vila umot hatzmehim mahi chibati etzlecha." For now I know, from now on I have a response to Satan and the nations who wonder what is my love towards you, says God to Abraham. Now I have a reason, for they see that you fear me. Once again, you have those two adversaries, the Satan on one hand, the Umot HaOlam, the nations of the world, on the other hand, and the idea is that the whole goal of the Akedah is to show that Abraham deserves the place that he occupies, and that even though there are those who challenge Abraham's place, Abraham earns his place and deserves his place, and the love that he has from God is earned and deserved. So, Devorah Schoenfeld argues in her book, Isaac on Jewish and Christian Altars, that, again, in more detail than I'm giving you now because we're out of time, that what you find here, even though Rashi never directly addresses people who would argue against the place of the Jewish people, the fact that Rashi crafts his commentary here by choosing sources that specifically point to the fact that Hashem loves Abraham, that specifically point to the fact that there are those who would challenge God's love for Abraham, but that Abraham has earned it and deserves it, that tells you that what Rashi is getting at here is that the point of the Akedah is to establish Abraham as a person who is deserving of God's love and who is deserving of the place that he occupies, even though there are people out there who challenge that and who claim that that's not true. The question is, again, because Rashi's comments are so terse, and because Rashi is really quoting Midrashim and Gemaras, etc., we always have to try to answer, but there's always sort of that big question mark, that boogeyman: does Rashi really mean this as a response to people who challenge Jewish people? Or is Rashi really just choosing Midrashim? Is he really just quoting rabbinic sources? And is he really just giving you a commentary on the Akedah? So that's the big question that remains open, and it's an ambiguity. And like we see, we have some scholars who are falling on one side, we have some scholars who are falling on the other side. I think it's an interesting reading of Rashi, and it's a compelling reading of Rashi to a certain extent. Again, given what we keep emphasizing, that Rashi does choose his sources carefully, that Rashi does put his commentary together with a lot of thought and with a lot of planning, it is very likely that Rashi really did choose the things that he chose for a good reason, and that he really does mean to emphasize God's love for Abraham and by extension for Abraham's descendants. Next week, we will get into a little bit more detail. We're going to look at Rashi's commentary on Nevi'im and Ketuvim, and we're going to get into a little bit more details about times that Rashi clearly and explicitly answers the charges of the Christians and clearly and explicitly answers the charges against the Jewish people. Now you can all go watch the ball game.